glorifying the murder of Fusilier Lee Rigby, the soldier who was killed in Woolwich in southeast London last May. They recorded and posted three videos on YouTube, which the Old Bailey judge described as offensive in the extreme. Police are carefully removing the bodies of four people killed in a helicopter crash in Norfolk last night. There are reports one of them, businessman Lord Bally Edmund, had complained to the manufacturers of the aircraft about safety issues. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
BCFM.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Friday Politics Show. Tony Gosling once more, and helping me review this week's news is the councillor for Easton. He's a Labour councillor, Afzal Shah. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappears on the way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The Boeing 777 turned west, changed course and altitude, then, according to Rolls-Royce, landed around about 2,200 miles away. So why the disinformation and contradictions from Malaysian military and government, and possibly from China too? And why don't the authorities be honest with the hundreds of families who've lost loved ones? Unlike Britain with the EU, Putin's not messing around with his Crimea referendum, and it'll all be over by Monday. Also, barrister Michael Shrimpton, who accused the former Prime Minister Ted Heath of being a paedophile and worse, is in court in London next week, but this time he's representing himself. We'll hear from Michael, who's representing himself in a being prosecuted for a nuclear bomb hoax at the London Olympics. Plus, David Powell's here from Friends of the Earth to explain, if you can, why the badger cull costs us around £30,000 per badger killed. Also, Occupy London still going strong as a think tank, and with the discussion gurus, we hear from Clive Menzies. He's an Occupy analyst, and he's looking at the European Union with the Occupy group in London. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 13 with a fairly sunny weekend. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, sunnier at the beginning of the week, cloudier, wetter and windier midweek onwards. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of March, highs of 10 and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for Easton, Afzal Shah. Hi, Afzal, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Martin. It's a pleasure.
I'm Tony, actually. That's Tony. That's Martin, pardon, over there. That's all right, Afzal. First of all, tell us why you got into politics.
Well, it's things that I saw going on around me that actually compelled me to get into politics. When you look at the state of the schools, it's also about trying to get more people into local voluntary positions, such as become magistrates or joining the police. And also, there was a number of thefts taking place, particularly in the Asian community, and I felt that the police were paying absolutely no heed whatsoever. In particular, in East Bristol, it was the Asian gold burglaries. And I personally represented 223 families who had been victims of this, and the police were taking no action. So I thought perhaps one way forward is to become a councillor.
So you say you represented these people. What is that in the context of being a lawyer?
No. I'm not a qualified lawyer, no. When I represented them, I represented them as far as the police is concerned. I had representations with with the police detectives and with the various officers, trying to find out why there was absolutely no action being taken place at
all. Okay, so you were sort of acting in a way as an unofficial lawyer by sort of getting people's ideas and putting them together, presenting them in a kind of almost like maybe a trade unionist or something in an official capacity. Tell us about those gold robberies and what was the upshot of it all? When are we talking about?
They've actually been they really. Distressed hundreds and hundreds of families around Bristol. It's something that's been taking place over the last 4 years. My family is actually a victim ourselves. With Asian gold, it tends to be passed down as a nest egg for the females when they get married. It's not that anyone's rich or anything, just that the price of gold has been astronomical over the last few years. And as it's become very difficult for criminals to make money from, say, drugs or other areas of criminality. Nice, easy pickings where they've broken into houses, especially during the month of Ramadan, when they see that the family's not in. But the problem is, you see, that it just causes extreme distress because it's not just the monetary value, it's also the sentimental value, because if it's passed down from your mother or from your grandmother, really distressing.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a cultural difference. This is not something generally, at least not normally in English society, that you would pass through the family a lump of gold as a sort of almost like finance or money. Most people in this country would have their money either invested or in a bank, wouldn't necessarily, maybe in shares or something. Are you saying that maybe for Asians they've got used over the years to maybe not trusting banks so much as we do here in England?
I think there's definitely a strong element. In the subcontinent, you don't have as much regulation as you do in this country.
Well, there's hardly any here.
So
you're a bit ahead of the game, aren't you? By having your wealth in something tangible, what you're doing is you're protecting yourself against crooked banking and banking collapses, which could possibly happen. But anyway, what's the situation now? Are the police taking these robberies more seriously?
The police really drag their feet on it. I think that they do understand that there is a problem there, but they've not really acted in the way that they should have. They should be a lot more proactive. But I have been doing some work with Safer Bristol. I think it's now down to the individuals, the actual families. What they've done is they felt compelled to actually put the money, conversely, into a bank safe. But where that's not available, people are having to take that risk. It's actually not a lump of gold. It's actually jewellery. Females' jewellery. You tend to see a lot of Asian women wearing it at weddings. And it really is it's a nest egg for a rainy day. But I do agree, especially with all the scandals that we've had in this country, I'd rather trust the age-old tradition of passing gold down rather than leaving it to greedy bankers.
Interesting. Also, why the Labour Party? Why not one of the other parties?
Well, Labour Party, see, I'm a bit of a socialist at heart, and,
What do you mean by that?
Social values, social justice, it's quite poignant because just in the last few days we've had two socialists die, two great examples of people who have actually led the way in fighting for social justice. Bob Crow, leader of the RMT union, and today with the passing of Tony Benn. And Tony Benn is a real inspiration to myself. I actually met him when I was a teenager in Westminster. But why Labour? Labour is a party that I've always been interested in. The whole purpose of Labour was for looking after the interests of the common man, hence with the unions, historically. If you look at the Lib Dems, we really don't know what the Lib Dems stand for these days, especially with Nick Clegg. As much as I will say that I've got a bit of a soft spot for Vince Cable, but I say soft spot a bit. As opposed to the Tories. Tories are completely about big business. But then again, the Labour Party does have its critics. The Blair of Tony Blair still... The ghost of Tony Blair still looms large in the background. So a lot of people are actually alienated because of Blair.
I'm glad you mentioned Bob Crowe, because we're going to hear now. It's fairly long, just over 5 minutes, but it's one of the speeches that the leader of the well, he's general secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, which took in a lot of other unions. I think he was originally National Union of Railwaymen, who died at age 52 on Monday this week. So let's hear now from the voice of, and the rant, if you can call it that, of Bob Crowe, and this was Bob's last speech that he gave in Ireland, and he went over to Ireland to give a speech at something called the James Connolly Festival. Martin, maybe we can hear from you afterwards a little bit about James Connolly. So here now is the last speech in Ireland given by the deceased, now sadly, RMT leader Bob Crowe.
His great-granddaughter is here today with us, and I wonder what he'll be saying, Jim. And he'd be talking about over 100 years ago, the society that he looked at, and the society that he wanted to see as the vision for people going forward. He wanted to see, over 100 years ago, full employment. He wanted to see social housing for everyone. He wanted to see a comprehensive education system for everyone. He wanted to see a health service at the point of need, from the cradle to the death. And hence the reason why we're now in a situation, over 100 years on, with no prospects of jobs for everyone, with the National Health Service being destroyed, with the entire fabric of society. And what people need to recognise the fact is that we can keep playing about with society and say they want a few quid spent here and we're not going to cut so much as the others. But the fact is, we have to recognise the fact, it's capitalism that's collapsed. It's failed. Capital has failed to give people full employment. Capital has failed to give people the society they want. And what happens when capital fails? It means that society breaks down. And it means it walks into wars and all kinds of other effects. Since I've been 14 years of age, I could never understand why a world that produces enough food to feed people twice all over, then further the world go to bed hungry every night. I could never understand why that the European Union farmers would rather burn crops than sell it and give it away to people. And I can never understand the reason why in this country and other countries where there's been coal, they've shut pits down and allowed coal to be dug up by seven-year-old kids and been farmed in from people with no union rights whatsoever. And then I recognise there's one thing that they really understand. If it makes money, then they can do it. If it doesn't make money, they can't give two hoots. You know, if there's a motorway crash here today, the ambulance services and the paramedics would turn up, and then people would be the same people that save people's lives. You won't see many stockbrokers jumping out of their cars on a motorway to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. You won't see these managing directors of hedge funds jumping out of motorways to giving people cardiac arrest a treatment. Of course you won't, because it's all down to money. And people better recognise the fact now that what took place in Britain last week, in my opinion, was no fluke. They say it's a protest vote that UKIP got. I don't think it's a protest vote at all. One in four people voted for a party because they didn't believe that the other three main parties had any kind of difference between them. The fact is, apart from small detail, and I accept in small detail there's difference, the Liberals, Labour and Tories all support privatisation. They all support keeping the anti-trade union laws, and they all support keeping us in the European Union. Why do you want to be in the European Union when it's the same European Union policies that is creating mass unemployment and imposing government policies on people? You've now got in Spain 27% of people unemployed. You've now got 20% reductions in pay taking place against our Greek comrades. And it ain't going to stop, because the reality is pretty simple. Either we're better organised than the bosses, or the bosses are better organised than us. If we're organised better than the bosses, you haven't got to have a degree in a university on finances. If you get a 10% increase in pay, it means the bosses get 10% less profits. And if the bosses have got a union that's compliant and can keep pay down, it means that the bosses improve their pay. So it's ever strongest at the given moment in time. And the reality, brothers and sisters, is social democracy has failed. Social democracy has laid the pavement down for the fascists to come in. And they better recognise their facts that up in South Shields, a strong Labour area, It's an absolute disaster for working people that a UKIP party, a right-wing party, got second in that vote up there. The reality is that people in our country should be determined right to have the say, do they want to be in the European Union or not? Because they won't challenge this question of immigration. You know, when people mention the word immigration, they say you're racist. We've got the right to mention about immigration to defend the citizens of our own country. Cuba, for example, is a socialist country. But you couldn't just go to Cuba and get a job unless you had a work permit. Australia and our friends in the Maritime Union of Australia, they've just got one of the fantastic agreements going with their country concerned. It means that Indigenous Australians, e.g. black people, Aborigines, have the right to a job before any other citizen of another country. And that's what it's all about. Because once you look after your citizens and pay them the rate of pay according to what they get with the employer, then you can say to other people in other countries, you can come and work, but you get paid the same rates of pay as your brother and your sister by the side of you. Our friends are the Bulgarians. Our friends are the Chinese. Our friends are the Vietnamese. Our friends are the Polish. It's the system that's wrong that makes two workers compete against each other for lower pay and lower conditions. Yeah. How is it, brothers and sisters, that yesterday the Defence Minister Hammond was talking about spending billions on a new Harrier, that Hawker jump jet. It's millions of pounds being spent. When it comes to producing new Trident nuclear weapons, all of a sudden, there's no worry there about austerity. But when it comes down to finding money to put people into hospitals and to finding drugs for people who've got cancer, then we can't find the money. Why is it they can find the money for the Royal Bank of Scotland when it was on its knees? How comes it could find the money for industries after industries like Northern Rock that was going on its knees? Shouldn't that be the wake-up call, what Jim Connell said, that if it's got to be a bankrupt industry to nationalise it, then if you can bring your lame ducks back into public ownership, then why can't you bring the white swans back, the insurance companies and the major companies back into public ownership and use that money for the benefit of people and everyone else? You know, the reality they're saying, even Henry Ford, a capitalist in his day, doubled his wages of his workers in the 20s in the Depression because he understood if more people had money in their pockets, they could buy more goods and it would rejuvenate society. If they want to give money away, why is it they're reducing the tax for the rich from 50 to 45%? We're only going to go out and stash it away in the bank rather than giving it to the pensioners. If you give every pensioner an extra £200 a year, they would go and spend it. If you give it to the unemployed, they would go and spend it. But they don't want it. When they say austerity is not working, it's not working for us, but it's working for that top 3% in society. Why is it in the Sunday Times Rich List that the top 3% in society over the last 8 years have improved their finances at the expense of other people? Because it all boils down to one thing. Everything we took for granted since World War II, the National Health Service, the decent comprehensive education, they want to dismantle it bit by bit. Because the bosses have an ideological hatred against working people. They don't want you to have nothing. They want you to have a piece of paper with your name on the top. And they will have to tell you that's the time you start, that's the time you finish, and use you like one of those lemons in a gin and tonic when they've used you and squeezed the juice out of you. They toss you to one side and they don't want it. So there's the time. It's no good to keep on looking back and marching for Jim Connell, the great man he was. But let's start making some of our own history. Let's start having a plaques about what's happening in 2013 and 2014. How are we going to end this austerity crisis and smash these bankers and capital? Brothers and sisters, I'm a pleasure to come over here year after year. But it's no good us marching and having resolutions. We've got to carry out the full impact. And that means militant trade unionism in the workplace, coupled with a political party that's prepared to roll its sleeves up and fight on behalf of working people like Thatcher did on behalf of big business.
Okay, there's Bob Crowe there, sadly died on Monday. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, he's winding himself up as he goes on and on there. But ultimately, he's saying it's actually, as his point he comes down to finally, it's about who's organised and who isn't.
Yes, I mean, it was a fairly wide-ranging speech, wasn't it? And I think probably the most significant political aspects of it were attacks on the Labour Party for betraying its own principles, because, of course, the RMT disaffiliated from the Labour Party under Bob Crowe's leadership. and I'm not a lot that I suspect AFSA would disagree with there, but. I think there is a political point about the Labour Party, which obviously I'm still in the Labour Party and so is AFSL, so in that sense we're not in the same exactly on the same page as Bob Crowe was.
AFSL, what are your thoughts about what you've just heard there? Because really he's been very critical of the Labour Party as really betraying its roots.
Well, it's quite interesting that he is critical of the Labour Party. Ed Miliband was actually selected by the strong vote from the unions, so he's got every
right. Not the RMT, of course, because they weren't affiliated.
Especially the RMT. And I can understand why sometimes people do make accusations that the Labour Party has forgotten its roots, their original roots, and they're looking towards the same perspective as the Tories, especially with big business. And I think that we got a bit too cosy with the city and the bankers, especially during Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's era.
Well, we've just had there, I mean, he's talking about the EU, for example, imposing laws which say you've got to be able to have economic migrants undercutting wages and really opening the doors to mass immigration, which even many migrants to this country are saying is gone too far. And he's saying, well, look, you know, what is the problem with criticising the European Union? What's happened just this week is that Ed Miliband has done, in a way, what Bob Crowe predicted. That was last week, by the way, that in that speech in Ireland. And he's saying, well, look, they're just lying down. They're doing what big business wants, and big business is in control in the EU.
Famous last words, of course, but it is a bit of a tricky one because you have to balance out, you know, I guess all three major party leaders, or perhaps you can say all four, but I don't really include the UKIPers, they've all got their eyes set on 2015, so they're trying to do a bit of a balancing act.
They're also looking at this May, aren't they? Because the European elections this May, that's going to, I suppose, set the scene for next year's general election here, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And I've actually been out campaigning for our candidates for the European elections, but it is very interesting, isn't it, that Europe has such a strong say about laws and how it dictates those laws in this country. But then again, there are some very good directives from the EU, protecting workers' rights. For example, if you go back, people who were working for on a temporary basis with employment agencies, they had very few rights. So, yeah, we have a look at the bigger picture. The EU does have its uses.
On to Tony Benn now, who died today, aged 88. He managed a lot more years than Bob Crowe did. I think maybe something to do with the fact that Bob Crowe was pretty overweight, wasn't he? Amazingly, a pity, really, and something for us all to think about, maybe. But Tony Benn, I worked with Tony Benn to set up a lecture series here in Britain, in Bristol back in 2006, along with Tom Trevor from the Arnold Feeney. And back in 2006, I think it was November, Tony delivered his lecture at the Arnold Feeney. It was called The Media and the Political Process. Many people didn't realise that Tony was actually a producer at the BBC after World War II. And it's a pity, really, in a way, that this lecture series has sort of lost its way, I think. I mean, I haven't been involved since about 2009 with it, and it's now become sort of subsumed into something called the Festival of Ideas, at least it was last year. But anyway, let's hear now from Tony Benn as part of that lecture that he gave back in 2006 at the Arnold Feeney. And he was making the point that media is actually the greatest power that the wealthy have got.
It's information is the most powerful weapon in the world, and always has been. Of course, if you have a gun and can control everybody else, the information they get is that if you disobey the leader, you'll be shot. That's information. And fear is information, and is used crudely now to control people. The church was a media. There was a time when you had to go to church. And then the control of what came out of religion. You see, in 1401, just before I was elected to the House of Commons, they passed the Heresy Act, under which it was a criminal offence for any person who wasn't a priest to read the Bible, because they didn't want the news of the Bible to get into the wrong hands. And you were burned at the stake. as a heretic if you read the Bible. The Church of England was nationalised. It's our oldest nationalised industry because it was so powerful. Then you had Caxton, you had Milton, his campaign for press freedom. The Royal Mail, I was Postmaster General once, and I wondered why Charles II had nationalised the post office. I thought, was he an early unrecognised socialist? The reason he did it was he wanted to open everybody's letters, and the only way he could do it was having the Royal Mail. So the Royal Mail was the birth of MI5. Then, of course, we had Rowland Hill, who was a 19th century precursor of the internet. People could get information for the first time. Then you had the BBC. Now, that was nationalised, too, because it was too powerful to leave in private hands. And now, of course, with Murdoch and the tabloids, you have it concentrated in many other ways. But influence is power. And we saw in the American elections one example of that. Now, having talked about the information we need, they don't want us to know anything, but they want to know all about us. They bug our phones, ID card, database, so that everything about us is known to them and can be used for what purposes they like. So that is the background, and the power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. And you see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days, it was land and factories. But now, it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have.
Martin, that was Tony Benn there speaking back in 2006. Information being the greatest power the wealthy have, and by implication, that's the media. And of course, the media is being put into fewer and fewer hands, almost all of them nowadays private.
Yeah, well, if you look around the world, there's a phenomenon that's appeared in the last 20 years. Well, it's always there, but it's got more pronounced, of media moguls who are also extremely wealthy manipulators. So you had Berezovsky in Russia, Maldonado in Brazil, Murdoch over here and in the US, and Gosinski in Russia as well.
Well, Berlusconi in Italy, mate.
Berlusconi in Italy, of course, another case. And Berlusconi is a classic case, it's the most extreme version of it. He's the richest guy in the country. He was at one stage the Prime Minister. And he controlled all the TV. And if that's not too much power for one person, I don't know what is, you know.
Afzal, what are your thoughts about the... And one of the things that Tony Benn was saying is that there's a too incestuous relationship between politics and the media.
Well, someone once said that, it's a weapon of mass distraction.
What do you think of the media in this city?
Well, I think that the media in this city... I'm all for independent radio stations such as BCFM, the media, well, Evening Post. Personally, I think that they're just a bit too close with our mayor, George Ferguson. Their job is to scrutinise, to ask questions, to investigate. But the other thing that you have seen in the Evening Post is plaudits for George. George has done this, George has done that. But just going back to the media, just earlier this week, that Tim Berners-Lee, the, as some people would put it, the godfather of the internet, the World Wide Web, even he was saying that our freedoms are actually under threat. It's the way that governments around the world are manipulating the media and also spying on people and fundamentally attacking our rights. And
well, we are allowed to see what we want to see just about pretty much still on the internet. It's just that everything's being tracked and traced, so there's no kind of idea of you being anonymous anymore. It seems pretty much privacy is out of the window.
I was just wondering, though, with social media, for example, is Twitter the great leveller? There was the case of David Cameron a few days earlier being told to shut up and get on with running the country by somebody on Twitter, and that was actually retweeted by thousands of people. So it is good to see that, you know, social media is now in the hands of the majority of people. But as Martin was actually saying, that there is this relationship that, you know, powerful people such as Murdoch in this country, Berlusconi in Italy, and in fact many people around the world manipulate the media. If you look at India, for example, Murdoch went in with Z Corporation and seems very very shady practices there, because he's got carte blanche to broadcast around the country, and everything that appears on the news channels seems to be pro-government. And I would urge people just to have a look. For example, there was this issue of the students in Indian-administered Kashmir who were supporting the Pakistani cricket team, and they were actually charged with sedition just for applauding the Pakistani team, just for cheering them on, clapping for them when they beat the Indian team just a week or so ago. And what does Rupert Murdoch's channel do, ZTV? They actually have interviews, not from the people who were charged, but from the police officers and from the local administrators.
Yeah, well, the danger is the media can just simply become a part of big business, a part of government, a part of the security state. But anyway, back to Tony Benn. Another final snippet from his lecture, The Media and the Political Process, which you can see online if you want to, on YouTube. It's been there since about 2006-2007. Fantastic lecture, I have to say. I was pretty impressed when I sat and watched it, and because he manages to mix some very serious topics with some of the greatest humorous anecdotes. And this in this extract, he's talking about his him after the Second World War, when he was discharged after the Second World War, and how that really made a big impression on him, wanting to stop all wars in the future.
I came back in a troop ship in the summer of 1945, and I heard the words of the Charter, the preamble of the Charter of the UN, and they're written in my heart. It said something very simple. It said, we the peoples of the United Nations. It didn't say we the coalition of the willing, or we the free peoples, or whatever. We the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge my generation, I'm 81, gave to the younger generation, and we tore it up when we went into Iraq. And UNESCO had a preamble in a way even simpler. It said, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. And that is what journalism should be able to do, to make it possible for people to see the simple, plain, stark truth that this generation is the first generation in human history that has the power to destroy the human race, kill one or two with a bow and arrow or a spear or a machine gun or a bomb. But with nuclear, chemical and biological weapons, it is possible to destroy the human race. But also, it's the first generation in human history that has the technology and the know-how and the money to solve the problems of the human race. A fraction of the cost of the war or the Trident, and everyone in Africa with AIDS would have had free drugs. Bush could have protected New Orleans from the Katrina. There could be a health service in America. And that's the choice. And so the information we get about that choice is crucial to our survival and integral to the role of the journalist.
Martin, in a way, similar points being made there by Bob Crowe earlier on and Tony Benn there, that it's all about whether the priority to spend money is on war or whether it's on ordinary people.
Yes, and obviously that's something I would agree with both of them about. I think also the other point is that both Tony Benn and Bob Crowe were anti-EU and in favour of a referendum. And of course, Ed Miliband recently has come out saying that there won't be a referendum if there's a Labour government. I think there are divisions on the left. They haven't gone away. I'm broadly in favour of the current position of the Labour leadership, but I don't think Bob Crowe or Tony Benn would have been.
What about the point that I asked you about, which was how we wrestle our governments to actually start prioritising ordinary people rather than wanting to, in a way, in a sort of macho fashion, try and spend lots of money on weapons?
I think that's the strongest suit of both political leaders. I mean, it's quite obvious to anybody looking at the society we live in now that it's grotesquely unfair and unequal. and we're spending all of our resources on making, you know, potential destruction of our species, and there's all these needs that should and could be met.
Bob Crowe's talked about the destruction of the fabric of society.
Well, the problem is we're going backwards. Gradually, you know, in the early part of my life, and I'm 54, things gradually improved for ordinary people. Wages rose, educational opportunities improved, society became more tolerant. But in the last few years in particular, we're going backwards, and we're reaching a situation, you know, where ordinary people have very little rights at work or out of work. And, you know, the powerful and the wealthy are riding roughshod over us.
OK, well, on to some of the stories from this week. And let's go to Westminster straight away, because David Cameron was over in Israel on Wednesday, speaking in the Knesset for the first time since he's Prime Minister. And so standing in for him was the Deputy Prime Minister, Lib Dem Nick Clegg. And asking the questions, instead of Ed Miliband this week, was the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman.
Secretary broke the law which gave local people a say, so decided to change the law. And the Lib Dems could have stepped in and stopped it. But oh no, here's what they did instead. First they said they were against the change, then they put down an amendment, then they sold out to the Tories, and the Tories got their way again. Is there any logic to how the Lib Dems vote other than self-interest?
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, this from a party that spent a quarter of £1 billion, £250 million, on sweetheart deals for the private sector, which led to operations and procedures which didn't help a single patient. A party which now rants and rails against competition in the NHS, but actually introduced it. A party which suffers from collective amnesia about the terrible suffering of the patients in mid-Staffordshire and other parts of the NHS, mismanaged by them.
Even fewer questions answered, I think, by Nick Clegg than normally get answered by David Cameron this week. But Afzal, what about the point that's being made there? Because Harriet Harman's trying to criticise Nick Clegg on supporting the Tories over the privatisation of the National Health Service, and he's just throwing it straight back in her face, saying, well, you started it all.
I've actually spoken to many nurses, so it's those individuals who are at the forefront of the NHS, and I've asked them, I said, look, take the politics out of it, tell me, do you believe that the NHS was better off under Labour or under the Condem government? And every single individual that I've spoken to, and it's been dozens of nurses over the past couple of years, they have unequivocally said that under Labour there was a lot more money, a lot more investment, and that as far as the Tories are concerned, they just don't get it. There are questions. Over the last few years, there was a lot of money. I don't know the exact figures, but it ranges from a few £100 million, not just a few, but hundreds of millions of pounds, to £1 billion on the IT system for the NHS. So there are lessons to be learnt, but only Labour can really protect the NHS.
I think that's right, but I think it's a fair point. I mean, Nick Clegg is saying it was Labour that brought in things like the private finance initiative in the NHS.
Yeah, £250 million worth of NHS
sweetheart deals. And it makes it very difficult for the Labour Party now to defend the NHS when they've actually opened the door to all of this in the past. But that doesn't make Nick Clegg right. I don't believe in the private finance initiative. I don't believe in the private sector being involved in the National Health Service. And I'm a Labour activist, and I've been a member since 1975. And I wasn't happy with what they were doing at the time. And I think people listening to the show have got to realise that the Labour Party is a broad church. It's got a right wing and a left wing, and I would see myself on the left of the party. But if you want to change it and you're not happy with the direction the party's in, well, you've got to join it and change it, and that's the business.
Okay, back to Westminster again, and a subject we touched on earlier, which is the election, the referendums for the European Union. And Peter Bone, taking advantage of the fact that David Cameron's not around, to make some points about the rather mixed-up policies from most of the main parties to do with whether or not the public is going to get a referendum on the EU, seeing that in many ways now the EU is more powerful than Westminster.
Mr. Speaker, we now know that the leader of the opposition is opposed to an EU referendum and won't deliver one. The Deputy Prime Minister is opposed to an EU referendum and won't deliver one. The leader of the UKIP party wants an EU referendum but can't deliver one. The Prime Minister wants an EU referendum and will deliver it by 2017. Would the stand-in Prime Minister tell the House which of the party leaders trusts the British people and is a real Democrat?
As ever, a pleasure. I'm glad to see he has fans on the other side of the House now as well as... Mr. Speaker, since he mentions my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, let me quote what he said at this dispatch box just a couple of years ago when we voted together on this very issue. And he said, and I quote, "My clear view is that it is when this Parliament proposes to give up powers that there should be a referendum. That is the guarantee we've written into law. It is important that we establish clear rules for the use of referendums in a parliamentary democracy. Rule one, line one is, if you're giving up powers that belong to the British people, you should ask them first." I entirely agree. That was the government's position then. That's what we legislated on, and that remains my view.
Well, it's all very well saying that, but those powers were given up quite a long time ago. You could always say, you know, well, let's have a referendum when we give up powers, but some of the key things have already been given up, and they certainly weren't voted for when people voted back in the 1970s to join the EEC. European Economic Community was more like the Maastricht Treaty, which has been in between times when much of the power's gone. Anyway, what about this issue of the EU, Afzal? Who's really running Britain? Is it Westminster or Brussels?
Well, just recently you had the most powerful person in Britain being the most powerful person in Europe, Angela Merkel, when she was visiting the UK. She was wined and dined by Cameron, who's hoping for concessions in the European Union. But I'm a firm believer that democracy is, you know, power for the people, by the people. And if you want true representation, then you must put it to the people. However, sometimes you do have to make tough decisions. And once again, it just goes back to that balancing act. You know, we're talking about Europe, but there's also the issue of Scotland. I mean, yeah, do the Scots want to be part of the United Kingdom?
Well, we'll certainly find out that later in the year. But what about my original question, which is, who's really running things? You know, Brussels or Westminster? When Westminster government wants to do something, but they're told by their lawyers you can't.
Well, there is this perception that it's Angela Merkel and François Hollande. I still think that the majority of laws in this country are actually the statutes and precedents actually made by Parliament.
Martin, what are your thoughts on this knotty issue, the referendum? Do you think the political parties have done the right thing? Most of them have kicked the can down
the
road.
People will have, at the next election, have a clear view. I mean, Neil Band has made his view clear. If you elect us, there won't be a referendum. So if you want a referendum, don't vote for us. But I think that's what we need to have a referendum on. Why are we in NATO? Why have we got US bases here? Why are we being dragged to war in Iraq and Afghanistan? I say, let's have a referendum on leaving NATO. And of course, that could easily happen if the Scots vote for independence. I don't think they will, but if they do, they could vote to leave NATO. And there's a question, are we going to have nuclear weapons? Because they're based on the Clyde, but nobody in Scotland wants them. And maybe we should just send them back to America, because that's where they come from in the first place. And who runs this country isn't Brussels. Brussels is like a glorified parish council. Who runs this country is the Pentagon and Wall Street, and they've always been run and they're the people who've always run this country.
Okay,
since World War II.
Another question up at Westminster. Lillian Greenwood. This is a by-election, but it's not. It's Clifton North she talks about, but it's not Clifton North here in Bristol. I don't even know if there is even a Clifton North ward. It's up north, somewhere else, another place. But it was a closely contested by-election in which the Lib Dems were knocked into fourth place behind a joke candidate.
Lillian Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, my constituents in Clifton North elected a new Labour council. Does the Deputy Prime Minister think it was his party's support for the bedroom tax, the trebling of tuition fees, unfair cuts to the poorest families, or the betrayal of the NHS, which led them to put Bus Pass Elvis ahead of the Liberal Democrats?
Mr. Speaker, putting Bus Pass Elvis aside for a minute, which I admit was a which I admit was a novel experience for us, as it no doubt was for the people of Clifton. I'm just wondering, did the Labour candidate admit to how much they'd cost every household in Clifton, £3,000? Did they admit to the fact that they allowed the bankers to run amok in 2008? Did they admit to the fact that they were the party that crashed the British economy? And did anyone on the doorstep apologise to the people of Clifton for what the Labour Party did to this country?
Well, another total failure to answer the question, even though it was a bit of a jokey one. The story here is that Bus Pass Elvis formed his own party. It's a pensioner dressed as Elvis who beat the Liberal Democrats in a local council by-election up in Nottingham. Afzal Shah, Labour councillor for Easton. What does this show us about how... I mean, if a joke candidate, almost like the monster raving loony party, can beat one of the main parties nowadays, it doesn't show that our politics is in a healthy state, does it?
I think people are quite disillusioned. People are fed up. They're sick and tired. They've seen all these scandals. They've actually seen members of Parliament several years earlier with the expenses scandal. And then you do see that there is a fairly low turnout, especially in the local elections. And I think politicians, whether they're members of parliament or councillors, need to set a good example, lead by example. Only then can they build that trust back, but it will take time.
But they're not doing that. This is a trouble in by-elections like this. And I mean, you can imagine if there was a sort of none of the above party, people might actually bother to turn out to vote for the none of the above party, because they're just not satisfied with what they're getting from the main parties in this country anymore.
As I said, people are dissatisfied because if you look at the Conservatives, they're all about representing the rich. If you look at the Lib Dems, people think that the Lib Dems haven't got a clue. They'll do anything to get into power. And believe you me, when the Labour Party does win the next election, Nick Clegg, or even if it's Vince Cable, who will be at the helm, they will be trying to get in bed with Labour.
Martin, I mean, this is the pensioner dressed as Elvis beats the Liberal Democrats. Lord Biro stood as a candidate for the Bus Pass Elvis Party, saying he wanted 30% discounts at legalised brothels for old age pensioners, and he gets in.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is the Labour Party won.
No, sorry, he didn't get in. The Labour Party won, but he does, you know, beating one of the three main parties is quite...
No, the Liberal Democrats were never, you know, they're strong in certain parts of the country, like the South West, but in other parts of the country, they're virtually non-existent.
Don't you think people are getting disillusioned with the main political party?
They are getting disillusioned with the main political party, and the fundamental problem with that is that governments don't decide what happens. It's decided in the City of London. It's decided in the Pentagon, as I said earlier. If we go to war over Ukraine or whatever, the local people in Britain won't have any say over that. It'll be decided by the US president in cahoots with people like Rupert Murdoch, and then we will be told. And that's the problem. We can carry on voting for whoever we want till doomsday.
Certainly, my experiences are that when I've been out canvassing, people have actually said to me that, oh, we used to be lifelong Labour supporters, but you know what? Stuff it. We're fed up, because we went out to London. We were part of the 1.5 million or so people who voted who were part of the demonstration in London, and they...
Against the Iraq war.
Categorically, yeah, said that they were against the Iraq war. They did not want the government to take them to Iraq. But what happened? They still went into war. They still went to Iraq. And these people say to me, why should we trust you? Why should we listen to you? Because it's not like our voice matters. It's all about interests. Just as Martin said, it's about the interests of the city. The city seems to be pulling the strings.
Okay, another story this week. The Bank of England has dropped a bombshell on Parliament. This is in something called the Wall Street on Parade magazine, which is a citizens' Wall Street watchdog in the US. Pam Martins says Mark Carney, head of the Bank of England, and Paul Fisher, executive director of markets, during a Treasury Select Committee grilling over destroying Bank of England records, Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, and other officials put through a 5-hour marathon of questioning by Parliament's Treasury Select Committee, covering everything from how long the Bank Bank of England plans to continue quantitative easing to the potential for Scotland to vote for its independence. But the bombshell did not occur until the session on the foreign exchange scandal, which is stacking up to be a more serious matter than the rigging of the LIBOR interest rate benchmarks. Fraud, again, which occurred under the nose of the Bank of England and the British Bankers Association. The bombshell came in the following exchange between Chair of Treasury Select Committee Andrew Tyrie and a frightened appearing Paul Fisher. Martin, these recordings have simply not been kept, apparently, from the Monetary Policy Committee from the period of around 2007 and 2008 when the banking collapse was a very near banking collapse. Certainly, this is when the bailout happened, the financial crisis, but apparently nobody knows what the Bank of England was discussing back then.
No, it's very suspicious, isn't it? And of course, Bank of England staff are actually implicated in these Forex scandals, so that's one part of the problem. And of course, the Federal Reserve in the United States isn't really owned by the government. And this is the real problem. The Bank of England is supposedly owned by the government, but unfortunately, they basically, they've been captured, it's what they call regulatory capture. They're supposedly a public institution, but people who work in the Bank of England are going to go and work in the private banks after they've worked in the Bank of England and vice versa. So they tend to do what the private
banks
want.
So they're making very important secret decisions at this Monetary Policy Committee. Some of the minutes are once approved minutes, so that is to say with various bits cut out, are released to the public. But the bits that aren't, which you would expect, maybe go to the Public Records Office, and because it's a public institution, people should know about after a period of time. Even that has been destroyed. Why do you say it's suspicious? Because it does. I mean,
well, it's what they've destroyed it because they're covering up malfeasance. That's why you destroy records like that.
So that you're
and the Federal
that
Reserve
could be criminal.
What the Federal Reserve have been doing is presenting edited minutes of meetings that supposedly took place during the crash, but they're not actually real. They're just an agreed story, an agreed fiction, and therefore the minutes are not real minutes. And the Federal Reserve, of course, is not actually a public institution, so I suppose they're entitled to say what they like. The Bank of England, it was nationalised in 1946, but it's in the pocket of the City of London. Let's just make one very important point. If we'd followed a free market policy, the private banking system would have been allowed to collapse. We didn't. We decided to bail it out, and David Cameron and Nick Clegg were all in favour of that at the time. But once you've bailed out the private banking system, private capitalism is finished. It's over.
Afsal, this does sound a bit suspicious. I mean, you were talking right at the very start about not really trusting the banks, and this is the Bank of England that we're supposed to control and own, that's supposed to be right in the key position in creating money, regulating the entire city, and yet they've shredded their records from the financial crisis. Martin's implying there that there may be evidence there of criminal activity and criminal offences that these people could be prosecuted for. Do you think that's why they shredded them?
Quite possibly. I have to be careful what I say, because they've got very expensive QCs. But when the story broke, I was just thinking to myself, here we go again. And we've had the PPI mis-selling scandal. Before that, it was a pension mis-selling scandal. After that, we had the mortgages.
We've had interest rate swaps. LIBOR.
The self-cert mortgages up to 125%. The whole issue around RBS, Northern Rock, Lloyds Bank. And then we've had the scandal with LIBOR. Now we've got Forex. I mean, yeah, how many more to come? What we need an independent judicial review where all the facts actually come out, and if any criminality has taken place, heads must roll.
Another story. Blacklisted workers serve an arrest warrant on Cullen McAlpine. This is the end of last month. Today, the blacklist is the 21st of February. Blacklist support group marked 5 years of inaction by the police by attempting to uphold the law themselves. Dave Smith, Helen Steele and a group of supporters visited the London offices of construction giant Sir Robert McAlpine Limited to make a citizen's arrest. Martin, this blacklisting is illegal. The evidence has been given to the police. The police have done absolutely nothing about it.
Yes, I mean, what's happened is that the step by step, criminality has become the standard procedure of the ruling class in this country and other countries. And black workers, basically several thousand workers, kept out of a living in the construction industry and other industries for years.
Well, they may have been
losing thousands of pounds in wages.
I mean, it's not just being kept out of a living, also the entire livelihood wiped out for the family. They may have been evicted from their homes,
indeed,
all sorts of things.
Indeed, and also, of course, we've got the special demonstration squad in infiltrating all of our movements, having children with our female activists and then running away, and all the rest of it. This is not a free society. It and never was, but it still isn't.
I mean, one of the most interesting paragraphs in this article, which is on realnews.co.uk, the guy from there we had on a couple of years ago on here, was the REEL, by the way, Real News. The Independent Police Complaints Commission is presently investigating police involvement in blacklisting. Already confirmed that Special Branch routinely provided information about prospective employees to these blacklisters.
Well, yes. I mean, therefore, the police are implicated in these illegal behaviours. What do we do about that?
Well, answer your own question.
Well, what you have to do is it is to go down the. You mentioned a judicial review there earlier. We don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We've got to get a rule of law in here. And if we had a rule of law in here, lots of very senior people would be in prison. And that's what's got to happen. The other alternative is that we don't have a rule of law, in which case we're going to have a civil war. And then people in Ireland know what I'm talking about when I mention that.
Afsar, what's your thoughts about blacklisting? So I know there has been actually a motion passed at the City Council against the company that now runs the... I think it's Kia, isn't it, that runs the... that took over May Gurney.
Kia May Gurney.
Yeah, maybe you could just tell us about it.
Yes, there has been a motion passed that... Bristol City Council actually stopped trading with any organisation that has been blacklisting its workers or its past workers, ex-employees. And this is something that not only affects those blacklisted workers, obviously affects their families, affects their friends as well. And it's actually symptomatic of wider corruption in today's society. Well, if you look at the police, well, if they're involved in this and they're culpable, then once again, we do need the rule of law in that. And perhaps, as I stated before, a judicial review is one way of actually getting to the bottom of this. But I think that the government needs to lead by example. Certainly locally, Bristol City Council must do everything that they can to cancel contracts with any company, any organisation that they find has indulged in this behaviour. They also need to sit down with the police and say that, as far as they're concerned, this must not be taking place in Bristol. So, in fact... that's something that that we could do locally with Sue Mount Stevens.
Okay. Well, it has to be said, this is mostly Special Branch that seems to have been handing over information to these blacklisters illegally. Anyway, well, now time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest. You just heard their Labour councillor for Eastern, Afzal Shah. After the Murdoch News, the Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappears. Why aren't the families being told what happened?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, high-level talks at solving the crisis in Ukraine have ended without agreement. America says it's strongly against this weekend's referendum in the Crimea region, where voters will decide whether to join Russia. Speaking through a translator, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insists Moscow's position is clear.
We have no single vision. There are still disagreements, and we expressed our opinion that we'll respect the will of Crimean people on the forthcoming referendum.
Tens of thousands of staff at Morrison's have had their bank account details posted online. The supermarket thinks the information was stolen from its payroll system internally. It's promised to compensate any worker who's been left out of pocket as a result. David Smith from the Information Commissioner's Office, which is responsible for data protection, says that